Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane's criminal trial is underway in Montgomery County. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Katie Culinary joins me with the latest details. And Katie, why is the state's chief law enforcement officer on trial, and how did we get here?
Well, Dave, it goes back to two newspaper articles, one in the Philadelphia Inquirer from March 2014 about how Kane declined to pursue criminal charges against Democratic state lawmakers who were caught taking gifts from an undercover operative. That was the first bit of bad press that she had since she had been elected as the state's first female attorney general. She was considered a Democratic rising star, and understandably, she was really incensed about it. 3 months later, an article in the Philadelphia Daily News about how Frank Fina, a top prosecutor under former Attorney General Tom Corbett, appeared. And that article was about how he declined to pursue criminal charges against former Philadelphia NAACP head Jerry Mondesir, who recently passed away. And Kane's office was revisiting that case. That second article, though, referenced two documents from a 2009 grand jury investigation of Mondesir's finances, documents that were secret, confidential, and are required by state law to stay that way. So that led to an investigation of Kane to find out how those documents were released to the press under her watch. Now, prosecutors believe that it was Kane who orchestrated the leak of those secret documents and that she lied about that under oath to cover it up.
And so what happened in court today?
Well, today we saw the state starting to lay out its case against her. We had opening statements to the jury, and prosecutors described a simple revenge plot. Kathleen Kane versus Frank Fina. That's the former state prosecutor who she believes was behind that first article in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Kane being behind the second article in the Philadelphia Daily News that was embarrassing to Fina. The prosecutors described Kane's actions as lies, leaks, and lawlessness. It was rather dramatic. Kane's defense team really disputed that idea of any feud between Kane and Fina. They said that the two hardly knew each other. She was only trying to do her job and trying to tell the public about this failed criminal investigation into Mondesir, and that there was no way she was going to throw away her historic election by doing something like this.
Katie, did you get a sense of how Kathleen Kane is reacting to this?
Yeah, I mean, she hasn't made any comments to the press as she's entering and exiting the courthouse. And in recent appearances to the press, she hasn't made any comments either. But I've been watching her throughout this whole thing, and she appears rather calm. She's watching very intently as the state is presenting all of its evidence and interviewing witnesses, and she's taking notes. So she seems to be an active participant in her own defense.
So how does everything you've brought to light so far pertain to Porngate, the email scandal involving pornographic emails trafficked among lawyers and judges?
Well, interestingly enough, that's the thing that the public may recognize the most, but it's actually a key part of Kane's defense that her attorneys are not allowed to bring up. Kane blames her legal problems on Fina and another former state prosecutor who she says conspired to manufacture the case against her in an attempt to keep her from revealing their role in Porngate, which, of course, she later did. But before the trial even got started, the judge, Wendy Jemchik-Aloy, ruled that the defense could not portray Kane as being the victim of what she called a vindictive prosecution. In other words, they could not bring up the whole Porngate motive here. So it's interesting to watch this week whether the porn emails still are worked in somehow, and that may happen if Fina testifies, where it's not clear whether he's going to or not, but it may happen if he takes the stand and the defense tries to tarnish his credibility that way.
Katie, leave us with a preview of what's likely on tap tomorrow.
Sure. So tomorrow we're going to be hearing more testimony from a key witness. His name is Bruce Beamer. He's now the state's inspector general. But when the Philadelphia Daily News article in 2014 came out, he was Kane's second in command, the first deputy attorney general. And during the first part of his testimony today, he talked about his reaction to that article and said he was shocked by it. It really troubled him because he realized that it was based on leaked documents that should not have been leaked to the public. And he asked Kane to investigate it. And his testimony was cut off short there, but we know from prior press reports that Kane actually kind of blew him off when he asked her to look into it and said the state's attorney general's office had more important things to do. So tomorrow the defense is going to cross-examine Beamer, and we're going to hear more of his testimony about what happened after he asked Kane to look into these leaked documents.
Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Katie Culinary, and we'll have updates throughout the week on NewsWorks Tonight. New estimates show exactly which New Jersey school districts would lose state aid under a new funding proposal by Governor Chris Christie. Though, as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, it's not changing the mind of supporters.
If Christie has his way, about a quarter of New Jersey school districts would lose a portion of their state aid, while the rest of the districts would see an increase. Those 143 districts that would lose out are mostly poor urban districts that could have trouble finding that money elsewhere.
This proposal of his is really taking New Jersey back decades, from decades of progress.
Danielle Ferry is the research director of the Newark-based Education Law Center, which calculated the figures.
It would bring us back to a time where there just are enormous disparities based on individual districts' ability to raise their own local revenue.
New Jersey currently distributes aid based on need, but Christie's plan would mete out aid evenly for each student. It's a massive overhaul of the formula. Take Vineland in Cumberland County, for example. Right now, it receives about $136 million in state aid. That would be cut by more than half. That means that the overall budget of the Vineland schools would shrink by 40%. But Republican State Senator Mike Doherty, who is sponsoring the measure, says that doesn't tell the story of all the other districts, which have to supplement their school budgets with higher property taxes.
Property taxes in the suburban areas have gotten so high because they get so little school aid that it's really impacting families all across New Jersey. It's impacting negatively real estate values.
But Doherty says in a legislature controlled by Democrats, the plan has no chance of passing right now. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
A link indicating which school districts would see their aid cut is available at newsworks.org. And still ahead this evening, parasitic nematodes are a wool farmer's biggest enemy.
In the West, there's people with, 2,000 acres, and they just kick their animals out and they let them go. And, the ones that survive are the hardy ones. And the ones that end up getting parasites aren't so lucky.
A New Jersey farm solution led to a major cash cow, or to be more accurate, cash yak. Details as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. When FBI agents raided the home of a powerful Philadelphia labor leader Friday, it was 3 days before Pennsylvania's attorney general was going on trial for perjury. And that comes just 6 weeks after a 20-year Philadelphia congressman was convicted on corruption charges and 1 month after a South Philadelphia ward leader was charged with bribery. All this, as a former state treasurer and a former gubernatorial chief of staff have pleaded guilty and are cooperating with prosecutors. And all that led WHYY's senior reporter Dave Davies to ask if we're moving backward or forward on the issue of public integrity. And have moves to strengthen ethics enforcement in Philly in recent years have had any effect? Well, here's Dave's report.
The seemingly incessant stories of investigations, indictments, and guilty pleas could leave you wondering, is there something in the water around here? Franklin and Marshall analyst Terry Madonna says, yeah, kinda.
Pennsylvania has 100 years of political corruption. It's deeply ingrained in the political culture that somehow never gets removed.
That's pretty discouraging. But why doesn't it change? John Contino, who spent 25 years as director of the Pennsylvania Ethics Commission, says we need stronger laws. He says Pennsylvania is behind other states on many areas of ethics legislation. Campaign finance contribution limits, restrictions on gifts, lobbying disclosure, and laws targeting pay-to-play by limiting political contributions from potential government contractors so they can't curry favor with politicians who control those contracts. So when Contino sees the indictment parade...
My reaction is why? Why are we not seeing some kind of movement to address the areas that seem to be resulting in most of the problems that have occurred?
While lawmakers in Harrisburg haven't exactly embraced ethics reform, things are a little different in Philadelphia. After the pay-to-play scandals of former Mayor John Street's administration in the early 2000s, City Council established a new ethics board with real staff and authority. They imposed campaign contribution limits and created a pay-to-play law that got national attention. Ethics Board Executive Director Shane Creamer says the effort has made a difference.
Within the last 10 years since the Ethics Board began operations, I cannot recall a single City of Philadelphia elected official or appointed official who has been indicted.
He has a point. The recent scandals have involved state lawmakers, the state treasurer, and a congressman. Many city officials have been cited by the Ethics Board for campaign finance violations and some conflicts of interest, but those were resolved with settlements and civil penalties rather than criminal convictions. Ann Creamer says that's the point. Politicians have learned to behave differently so they don't get indicted.
I think the climate has changed. I think the expectations have changed. And I think that especially those in the administration and especially in city council are aware that, you know, the rules matter.
So if Philadelphia's elected leaders tightened the rules on ethics after a scandal, why didn't lawmakers in Harrisburg do the same thing? Could it be we just pay more attention to mayors and council members than state legislators? David Thornburg, president of the Watchdog Group Committee of 70, says it may be there just isn't yet sufficient voter demand for toughening the laws.
Unless and until voters in particular, because politicians are very sensitive to voters, unless and until voters, you know, make it clear that enough is enough and we're not tolerating this, I don't think we're going to see a change in conduct across the board.
Thornburg says a lot of voters don't realize how much even small things, like calling a lawmaker's office, writing a letter, or circulating a neighborhood petition can get a public official's attention. We won't get more honest government, he says, until we demand it. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
What's a farmer to do when large portions of the property become unusable? Well, that was the challenge facing the owners of Woods Edge Wool's Farm in Stockton, New Jersey, when they discovered the white-tailed deer near their land carried a deadly parasite, the meningeal worm. The parasite attacks the spinal cord of hoofed animals, which are essential to fiber production. The farm's owners, Brent Walker and Amy Serge, have since protected their alpacas and llamas from the parasite, though the introduction of livestock resistance to infection has made a major impact on their business. I join Newsworks Tonight producer Brett Rader in a recent visit to Woods Edge, where Tibetan yaks are big business.
That's their feeder. So we'll give them a little bit of grain every morning, and that's mainly for training them. They don't normally get out, but if you have like a tree down on the fence, like a couple Thanksgivings ago, they were in the road. Like, you shake the grain and they kind of come running. So
did you get them all back
on
the road?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they love their food.
So. Today, you know, they're kind of right congregated at the top of the hill. The breeze is coming over. I put a fresh round bale of hay out there, and they're just there in heaven. They are in heaven. Let me get some. Let me get some alfalfa pellets.
And so, what's the demand?
For me, I can't raise them fast enough. We are sold out of breeding stock. I am limited supply on meat. We do still, at our 7 farmers markets, offer yak meat for sale, but at limited quantities at all the locations.
But let's quickly note that we were talking about meat, but most of your sales are in non-meat products, in the wool.
Correct. My primary business is selling the llama and alpaca hair and even the yak hair made into socks, mittens, hats, gloves, blankets, yarn.
And that you've been at for a long time.
Yes.
In fact, you have a distinction as the first.
We were the first alpaca farm in the state of New Jersey. And for the farm, this is 40 years in business.
How many alpaca and llamas do you have?
We have right now about 100, 125 all together with the yaks, the llamas, and alpacas, depending on how many we sell, how many are you know, born, things like that. You know, yak we process. The number is always fluctuating.
Do you buy alpaca and llamas primarily to sell or to just continue to harvest the wool here?
We raise all our llamas and alpacas here, and then I'll breed to sell the offspring to other alpaca farmers.
They're obviously kept away strategically from the risk of getting the deer-borne tick. Mm-hmm. But they don't get parasites that require
the alpacas and llamas?
that require veterinarian interventions as a rule?
We do everything.
We can vaccinate
worm
them
in-house. So there's a kind of different rules of thumbs for warming the animals. We tend to look at eyelid colors and see, you know, bright pink, very healthy, lighter white, anemic. Those are the ones that you with a warmer. And some of them are just, a lot of people try to breed that resistance in them. On the West, there's people with, you know, 2,000 acres, and they just kick their animals out and they let them go. And, you know, the ones that survive are the hardy ones. And the ones that end up getting parasites aren't so lucky.
Well, among other things, you don't have 2,000 acres.
Exactly. So for us, we, you know, we'll bring them in, you know, every 6 to 8 weeks and, you know, monitor them, check all eyelids just to see if somebody needs a little bit of assistance. We'll give them, you know, B vitamin shots or we'll give them a dewormer.
We all have to eat. No farmers, no food. That's the number one tagline you see everywhere, and that's true. The farmers are getting fewer and far between. A lot of it's going to big commercial operations, even overseas, and the smaller farmer is trying to do what they can and do more direct marketing here, you know, in the Northeast.
Toward that end, is there a collaborative effort between like-minded farmers? And do you learn and trade tips and secrets and suggestions?
It's getting better. You know, farming 20 years ago was, you know, no one wanted to talk about it. No one wanted to have people out at the farm. And now with the influx of local farmers markets, there's more farmers we're talking, you know, get a network together. When we had the one hurricane, I had to help the one farmer. He didn't have a generator for his well. He had 20 cows to water. You know, the animals have to get water. And you don't think about stuff like that when, you know, you have all these animals dependent on you. You have to be out there ahead of the game, being ready for bad weather, talking to other farmers. Oh, do you have a water tank? Oh, do you have the generator? You know, can I use this? Or you have one out.
Weather, of course, is always a variable, but all you need to do apparently is just listen to the yak.
Yes. Over the last 5-6 years of processing yak, with the last two winters that were brutal for most of us, the yak actually knew. We saw an increase in fat on the outside of the meat, which I couldn't explain the first year until we survived the first winter. As soon as the winter was over, they lost that fat because they needed the extra fat to make it through the winter. We processed a few more. The meat was back to normal. And then again, when we processed some in December, they had already had fat on them. This year, when we processed in the fall, there was no fat and we didn't have a bad winter. So it's they have that sixth sense of, you know, when winter's going to be bad, they need to put on some more insulation for them to survive winter.
I have a lot more questions, but you're a farmer, so I'll have to let you get back to the fields. Thanks so much for your time.
Anytime. Thanks for coming out today, guys.
That's Brett Walker. He owns Woods Edge Wools Farm in Stockton, New Jersey, with Amy Serage. You can see lots of photos of our visit to the farm at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader, with additional production today from Ty Johnson. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.